This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Jane Fonda. It is possible to trace recent American history just by watching Fonda's persona, wrote Peter Bronstein in American Heritage magazine 4 years ago. Quote, she was libertine in the 60s, radical by decade's end, progressive in the 70s, entrepreneurial in the 80s, and corporate grande dame in the 90s, unquote. People still argue about her meaning in American culture, particularly the impact of her anti-war protests in the 60s. Now she has a lot to add to her interpretations of her life. She's written a new memoir called My Life So Far, in which she talks about everything from her relationships with her father and her husbands to her own acting career, her eating disorder, her trip to North Vietnam, her aerobics videos, and of course her movies. After a 15-year hiatus, she's starring in the soon-to-be-released comedy Monster in Law. Before we talk, let's hear a scene from her 1981 film On Golden Pond, which was her father Henry Fonda's last movie. She played his estranged daughter, who was trying to get closer.
Norman, I want to talk to you.
Well, it seems to be the problem.
There's no problem. I want to talk to you. I think that maybe you and I should have the kind of relationship that we're supposed to have.
What kind of relationship is that?
Well, you know, like a father and a daughter.
Yeah, just in the nick of time, huh? Worried about the will, are you? Well, I'm leaving everything to you except what I'm taking with me.
Just stop it. I don't want anything. It seems that you and me have been mad at each other for so long.
I didn't know we were mad, although we just didn't like each other.
Jane Fonda, growing up with a movie star father, did being a movie star seem appealing to you?
No, not at all. I never connected acting with joy. My father never brought joy home with him. He only brought kvetching and problems. So that's one reason why I didn't want to do it. And then another is because... I don't know, I thought actors were too egocentric, and I was plain, and I was shy, and it just didn't seem something I wanted to do.
Well, you thought you were plain anyways. I mean, I don't think you really were, but...
All that matters is what you think.
I suppose that's true.
That's right.
Outside of getting work, because other people don't necessarily, you know, share your opinion, and particularly in modeling and acting... It's largely based on what other people think. But we'll get to that in a minute. When you started acting, you were studying the method with Lee Strasberg. And your father thought the method was ridiculous. Why did he think it was absurd?
Well, I think for two reasons. When he became an actor in the 30s, there wasn't so many people trying to get those few parts. It wasn't as competitive. And before he ever made it on Broadway and in the movies, he must have performed in 300 productions of summer stock and touring companies. He was a member of the University Players, which was a summer acting company. And that was his school. And he didn't understand why everyone couldn't do that. He didn't realize that when I came along, and even more so, it's true now for my niece Bridget and my son Troy, it's very, very competitive. You have to, by the time you go up for your first audition, you better be prepared and have a technique and all that. But there was another deeper reason why he didn't approve, which I really came to understand most acutely while I was writing my book, and that is the approach that Lee Strasberg took was one that required you to develop tremendous self-understanding. You had to plumb your depths. You had to figure out what were the things that caused you to tighten up and get shallow breath and be frightened, and what were the things that caused you to let go and release. And you had to really be willing to do some self exploration psychically. A lot of the actors who studied with him were in analysis or in therapy. Well, for my father, and this is partly generational, part he came from the Midwest, and it's partly just his nature. He hated it. He hated introspection. He hated therapy. He didn't like the messiness of it all. When he performed, he always liked everything to be just the way it had been at rehearsal. And I think it scared him, although he he wouldn't have said it that way, but I'm pretty sure that's why he disdained it so much. And, you know, pat myself on the back. It took some perseverance and some courage for me to continue doing it, because I adored my father in spite of his dismissiveness.
So what was it like for you to expose yourself in the way you need to expose yourself when you're acting and practicing the method?
It was like a breath of fresh air. It was for a girl who grew up in the 50s and who was brought up to know that you just didn't bring your feelings to the table. You didn't talk about them. It was a no-no. You didn't express emotions. Suddenly I found myself in a situation where you were asked to delve deep. You were asked to reveal those things, and it was safe to do so. And it changed my life.
How did it change your life?
Well, I was floundering. I was 21 years old, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. I tried being a secretary, and I was fired. I got into acting by default, and I sat in his classes, Lee's classes, the private classes, not the actor's studio, for several months. I sat right behind Marilyn Monroe, who always wore a scarf and a trench coat, and I would look past her cheek to the stage, and she was as frightened as I was to get up there. She never did. And I sort of thought, well, you know, maybe Dad's right. Maybe this is just too ridiculous. But I thought, well, before I give it up, I might as well do at least one exercise. And so I did. And when I finished, I'll never forget it. Lee Strasberg, he was very quiet. And then he said, Jane, I see a lot of actors go through here. And I want to tell you, you have real talent. And Terry, I can't even describe it. It just felt like the top of my head came off and birds flew out and the color of life changed. And it was never quite the same. And, you know, Lee didn't have to tell me that. He wasn't an employee of my father's or a family friend. And it meant the world to me. And I'd already discovered he wasn't somebody that made nice.
So acting, among other things, gave you confidence because you were good at it. But at the same time, it brought out insecurities about how you looked. You know, you'd started modeling at the same time. And, of course, when you're acting, particularly probably when you're a woman, you're really judged by how you look. So what were some of the insecurities about your body and your face that acting helped bring to the surface?
Well, the insecurities existed for reasons that went back earlier than the acting. When I was in the safe womb of Lee's classes, it was fine. I was safe. It was okay. But when I went to Hollywood, which was quite soon after I started taking Lee's classes and made my first movie, which was Tall Story, it became quite a different situation. For example, when I did my first screen test, Jack Warner, who was for Warner Brothers, it was a Warner studio picture, and Jack Warner sent down a message saying that he wanted me to wear falsies for the movie. That I was too flat-chested. Josh Logan, who was the director, and I think he was my godfather, he took my chin in his hand one day and turned me to profile and said, "You know, after this film is over, if you broke your jaw and had your back teeth removed, your face wouldn't be so round." Anyway, it all played on my insecurities, and when I finished that movie, I went back home to New York and vowed I'd never go back to Hollywood.
Well, one of your early movies was Barbarella, which was directed by your husband, Roger Vadim. And in the famous opening scene, the credit sequence, you're stripping out of your spacesuit and you're weightless. So you're kind of like floating and becoming increasingly naked until you are naked. And the very private parts are obscured, but still you're there naked. And for somebody who is or was self-conscious about her body. What a difficult spot to be in, huh?
You have no idea. I was totally drunk. I did so many things that I would rather die than do, but I didn't know that I could say no. I literally didn't know I could say no. I didn't want anybody to know that I felt uncomfortable in my skin and that I hated my body and that... I just did it.
What does it say about Roger Vadim that he asked you to do that? I mean, if he knew you well, he must have known something about how self-conscious you were.
I'm a good actress. He had no idea. He had no idea that I felt that uncomfortable. He'd been married to Bridget Bardot before me, and I thought if I told him how ugly I thought I was, that it would call his attention to it. I don't think he realized.
So how did you get through the scene?
I got drunk.
Oh, you really did get drunk?
Yeah. Got drunk a lot to get through things that I didn't really want to do.
You say that you even betrayed your body. Are you referring there to, like you write in your book, that when you were married to Roger Vadim, you wanted to do threesomes, and you weren't comfortable with that, but you didn't want to say no either?
I didn't think I was good enough. It never occurred to me that I would be good enough. And
well, good enough to say no?
That's right. Good enough to be the only one. It was simply too hard for me to say, I want to be the only one. If you want me to really open my heart totally and deeply and my soul to you, I have to know that I'm the only one. I couldn't say it because I thought he'd leave me. Isn't that amazing?
My guest is Jane Fonda. Her new autobiography is called My Life So Far. We'll talk more after a break. Here's the opening scene from her 1968 film Barbarella. She's naked in her space pad, talking to the president, who's on the video phone.
Have you ever heard of a young scientist named Durand Durand?
Yes.
Recently, while on a trip to the North Star, he vanished into the uncharted regions of Tau Ceti.
But why is that a secret?
Because Durand Durand is the inventor of the positronic ray. It's a weapon.
Weapon? Why would anybody want to invent a weapon?
How should I know?
I mean, the universe has been pacified for centuries, sir.
What we know of it. The trouble is we don't know anything about Tau Ceti or its inhabitants.
You mean they could still be living in a primitive state of neurotic irresponsibility?
Precisely. And if they are, and if they have learned from this young scientist the unspeakable secret of the positronic ray, well, it may give them the power to shatter the loving union of the universe.
But that could lead to archaic insecurity and...
And war.
You mean selfish competition and...
I mean war. Bloody conflict between entire tribes.
I don't believe it.
Neither do I.
I think you already had an eating disorder when you did Barbarella.
Yes. I began to be anorexic bulimic in high school, as happens a lot with girls.
How did you learn about bulimia?
I had a roommate who told me that she'd read in Roman history books that that's what the Romans did. They would gorge on a feast and then throw it all up so they could do it all over again, and she and I started doing it, and we thought we were the only people since the Romans that did it. I didn't know there was a name. I didn't know there was a name for it until I wrote my first workout book. And I knew I had to fess up in order to give resonance to my journey from what I had been to the healthy person I became. And so that's when I discovered there was a word called bulimia. I didn't know.
In your memoir, you say that in some of your movies and in your modeling work that you did when you started your career, you can see the trouble on your face. What do you see when you look at your face then?
I see absence, and it began when I was about 14, I think, which for me was the cusp of adolescence. When I realized that I was not perfect, nobody's perfect, but we're made to believe that we're supposed to be perfect. And my father had let me know in all kinds of ways that he thought I was too fat. And so my lack of perfection suddenly reared its head when I entered the period of life when you're supposed to be becoming a woman and be feminine and be popular and things like that. And, you know, before I'd been too busy wrestling and climbing trees, and suddenly Well, I just moved out of myself. I moved outside and took up residence next door, and leaving a big empty hole in the center of me, which became filled with anxieties, which I spend a lot of time with young girls, and I know that it's very common, this sudden anxiety that appears on the horizon when you hit puberty. I filled it with food. And other people fill it with, I don't know, drugs, shopping.
Right.
Buying shoes, gambling. It can be filled with lots of things. I filled it with food and, to some extent, alcohol.
But you had to get rid of it.
Well, yeah. It's a very, it's a complicated thing that happens. You're empty, and you don't realize that what you're empty from is spirit and soul. You've moved that outside yourself, and so you're trying to fill it with whatever gives you comfort, and until you, the addict, realize what it is that you're really searching for, even if you stop the behavior, which I did in my mid-40s, I stopped binging and purging, but I was like a dry drunk. I hadn't dealt with the emptiness. That took longer. But that's what you have to do to really be healed.
I've heard a lot of women say that, you know, being pregnant is the only time when it's acceptable to have a tummy. And so it's a time when you can relax about food. How did you feel about your body image when you were pregnant?
I loved being pregnant. I think partly it was hormonal. The hormones went well with me. I needed them, and whatever they were, they were good. And I was very, very happy when I was pregnant. It was excusable, as you said, to have a belly.
Did you ever think of aerobics as being a compulsive way of replacing compulsive eating and purging?
Totally, yes. With me, it was compulsive, but I'll tell you what, it was a step in the right direction.
Right.
It's about control. You want to feel you have some control, and if you go cold turkey from anorexia and bulimia, you have to find another way to feel that you can control your body. And exercise is a healthy way. And for me, although I didn't realize it until I began to write my book, the workout with its movement and its music and its tempo and its drive was a beginning of moving, if not back inside my body, at least up onto the front porch.
Did the self-consciousness about acting ever go away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. The fear, that's different than self-conscious. I always thought that the more you did something, the easier it would get. What I discovered in my own career was that towards the end it got harder and harder. Maybe I was expecting more of myself, but there were deeper, more personal reasons. I was terrified, and it wasn't self-conscious. It just, I don't know. Well, I was living in my head on sheer willpower, and that's not good if you're trying to be creative.
Now, your brother, Peter Fonda, had a memoir that came out a few years ago. And I'm wondering if you read that memoir and if that affected how you wrote yours and what you decided to put in or withhold.
Well, I went to it for as I did to, I mean, practically everybody I know has an autobiography.
Yeah, right.
Ted didn't write one, but Tom wrote one. Vadim wrote two, and about five books have been written about Ted. And, you know, reading them all, what I knew I didn't want to do was, and then I did this, and then I did that, and then I did this, and then I did that. I wanted to write a book that the reader would be constantly putting down because he or she had to think about his own or her own life and her own relationship. And I'm discovering that I succeeded, that's what people are finding themselves doing, men and women. It's fascinating. When you've spent almost 5 years writing something and then you're finally being interviewed by people who have read it, it's totally fascinating.
My guest is Jane Fonda. Here's a scene from her 1971 thriller, Clute. She played an actress and call girl. In this scene, she's talking with her therapist about why she can't stop turning tricks.
What's the difference between going out on a call as a model or as an actress or as a call girl? You're successful as a call girl. You're not successful.
Because when you're a call girl, you control it. That's why. Because someone wants you? Not me. I mean, there are some Johns that I have regularly that want me, and that's terrific. But they want a woman, and I know I'm good. And I arrive at their hotel or their apartment. And they're usually nervous, which is fine, because I'm not. I know what I'm doing. And for an hour, I'm the best actress in the world and the best in the world.
A lot of your book is trying to figure out who you are and why you transformed yourself several times, in part to suit what you thought were the needs or desires of the men in your life, from your father, Henry Fonda, to your husbands, Roger Vadim, who was a French director, and Tom Hayden, an anti-war activist, Ted Turner, the head of CNN. Let's start with your father. You write a little bit about how you and your brother Peter Fonda dealt differently with your father. You say, Peter was who he was. When he was scared, he showed it. If he was sick, he'd complain about it. Damn the consequences. I often wished he'd pretend like I did just to make things easier. But Peter was himself, and I'd got into the habit of leaving myself behind someplace in order to win Dad's approval.
That's right. I knew viscerally what he wanted, and I was going to give it to him because he was the wagon that I wanted to... He was the star that I wanted to hitch my wagon to. He was the team I wanted to be on. I didn't want to risk losing his approval. And that sets in motion an unhealthy dynamic between a girl and the future men in her life. It was the approval of my father and then later the approval of men that would make me okay. And if I lost that, I would cease to exist. It gets that deep. And, you know, so the need to be perfect and the need to please was my modus operandi. Now, at the same time, because in writing my book, I had to try to understand whether the rap on me, which is there's no there, it's only, you know, I just become whatever the man I'm with wants me to be, whether that's true or not. And I discovered that it wasn't true, that I've always been on a quest, in a way, to find the center of things, including the center of myself. And in each of my marriages, I've been partway on a path in that quest when I would meet a man who would take me further down that path. You know, I always hoped that it would be for the long haul, but, you know, I wasn't dealt the cards to make the long haul with one person. And if it ever happens again, I'll be comforted by the fact that the haul is shorter. But my father was married 5 times, and, you know, I didn't choose well for the long haul, but I chose very well for getting me further down the path that I wanted to be on. I agree with Katharine Hepburn, women choose the men.
But I guess you had this, like, guru thing going, that you chose men in your life who could be, like, the leader, the guide, the scout.
When I moved to France to make a movie with Alain Delon, directed by René Clément, I was on a search. I wanted to discover womanness. I never had a female role model. My mother killed herself when I was 12, and I was very frightened of what it meant to be a woman, because I thought it meant being a victim and dying. And I was drawn to Europe. I didn't consciously say, in Europe I will find out what it means to be a woman. But then I met Vadim, and, you know, God knows, he was somebody who could take a woman down the path of womanliness, and he did, and I'm very grateful to him for it. When I met Tom Hayden, I had left Vadim and moved back to the United States because I wanted to be part of the anti-war movement. It was 1968, and I had just turned 30, and I wanted to make a difference. I was an activist for 2.5 years working with the GI movement, feeling a little bit, I needed context. I wanted a political home, a political womb in which I could find love and friendship and structure. I was kind of out on my own because I was so different than other activists. I mean, here I'd made Barbarella and I was a famous movie star, but I didn't want to be like a movie star. I wanted to be like an average person, and I couldn't do it on my own. And that's when I met Tom Hayden, who was, you know, who had tremendous vision and depth of vision and scope of politics, and he was the one, and he was perfect, and he was just wonderful.
In a way, Ted Turner seems like such a contrast to that, because it brings you into the corporate world. And, you know,
right.
The corporate world and the radical world that you and Tom Hayden lived in are just totally opposite.
On a superficial level, it does seem weird, and certainly it hurt me when people interpreted my marrying Ted on the superficial level, but talk about the deeper parts. First of all, energetically, Ted and I were very much alike. We both have parents that killed themselves. He was someone that would not be intimidated by my success and persona, and he cared deeply about making things better. His life was devoted, and he had devoted his CNN to making a difference, to peace, to environmental protection. I loved his values, and there was this incredible, beautiful synergy between the two of us for the 10 years that we were together. Besides that, he gave me tremendous confidence. He didn't put me down. He always let me know that he needed me, and I needed to be needed. And when someone like Ted Turner lets you know that you're needed, you know, it counts. And whatever the problems were, I began to heal in the arms of Ted.
Let's talk a little bit about politics.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised that in 2004, years after, you know, 3 decades after the Vietnam War, that you were still used as a symbol during the presidential election? And you know, there was that image of you and John Kerry at a political demonstration together, an image that was faked, because this was a demonstration that you were not at together. Were you surprised that you still had this kind of symbolic power?
No, I was not surprised for a number of reasons. First of all, I knew that that side of the political spectrum was mean, nasty, and would resort to anything. So it did not surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that veterans are still angry and enraged. I think that their rage directed at me is misguided. It wasn't my war. I didn't send them there. I was very close to soldiers. They're the people who got me into the war. But I made a mistake by sitting on an anti-aircraft gun without even thinking what I was doing. The image did not reflect what was in my heart, but the image exists. And I understand why guys are angry about that. And, you know, I hope the time will come. I hope my book will help them understand where my heart was and my head. And if they're going to feel rage, let them feel it for the people who create these kind of wars and then lie to the American people about the wars and send them into harm's way based on lies. Now, there's a whole other segment, though, that are like these swift boat types that have created a myth about me that is bigger than reality. I mean, I'm just this tiny little thing compared to this myth that they have created. And they need the myth. They thrive on the myth. They use the myth to promulgate a narrow right-wing view, worldview.
Who is this mythical Jane Fonda?
Oh, the myth that they want to foment is that I went to North Vietnam siding with the enemy, that I sat on an anti-aircraft gun, that I was aiming at planes, that I was against the American soldiers. What they have to be able to convince people of is that if you're against the war, you're against the soldiers. And God knows that image of me in an anti-aircraft gun played right into that. It was the most horrific lapse of judgment that I could have done, and I'll go to my grave, as I've said before, regretting it. It was not at all what was in my heart. It had nothing to do with how I felt. You know, the fact is that you can be opposed to the war, and you can speak out against it and protest it and be very pro-soldier. When you know that a war is wrong and that it's based on lies, the way to be pro-soldier is to expose the lies, try to end the war, and get them home as quickly as possible. As a lot, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of GIs and returned Vietnam veterans knew, and a lot of Iraqi veterans and their families know today.
You referred to this photo where you're seated at an anti-aircraft gun in North Vietnam, a gun that would have been used to shoot down American planes. Before we talk about that specific photo, why did you go to North Vietnam in the first place?
Word was coming back to us that the Nixon administration was bombing the dikes of North Vietnam. And we knew what that meant. We knew that if the dikes were bombed before the monsoon season, that, well, Henry Kissinger estimated 200,000 people would die because of starvation. It had been proposed before during the Johnson administration, and to his credit, Johnson had said, no, we can't be responsible for this. But word was that Nixon was doing it. Now, Nixon was lying to us. He and his administration was telling the American people that the war was ending. He was bringing ground troops home. When I went to North Vietnam, there was only barely even a battalion of ground troops in South Vietnam. But I went to expose the bombing of the dikes, to find out for myself, A, whether it was true, and if it was true, to film it and bring back evidence. And that's why I went. And I brought back evidence. I went in July of 1972. The bombing stopped in August, the bombing of the dikes. And I have in my book transcripts of tapes from the White House that shows that Nixon was saying, we're going to go for the dikes. We're going to cream them. We're going to win this war. We're going to cream North Vietnam, and I'm all for the dikes. He also said, never mind the civilian deaths. Never mind. I'm all for it.
Now let's get to the photograph that you mentioned where you're seated at an anti-aircraft gun in North Vietnam, a gun that would be used to shoot down American aircraft. You said this is one of the biggest regrets of your life, that you allowed this picture. How did the picture come to be?
It was the last day of a two-week stay in North Vietnam. I had wanted them to, on my agenda, it said visit a military site, and I hadn't wanted to do that, but I just went. Other American visitors, there had been 300 before me, you know, oftentimes visited military sites. It was an inactive gun. There were no planes or anything like that. I got there. There was a group of soldiers who greeted me and sang me, and there were a lot of journalists were there, which should have been a red flag, a lot more than I'd ever seen all together in one place. And these young soldiers sang me a song that moved me very much. And then in Vietnamese, I had a translator standing right next to me. It contained the words of our Declaration of Independence. And then they asked me to sing them a song, and I did. And I tried to sing in Vietnamese, and everybody was laughing and clapping, and I was laughing and clapping, and someone kind of took me over and sat me down in the gun. And I didn't even think about it until after I got up. And I realized, oh, my God, if these pictures are going to look like I'm siding with the enemy. And I asked my translator to don't publish, get rid of those photos. That's terrible. Anyway, it's the photo exists, and I learned a great lesson that what can be in your heart is not necessarily what is going to appear. I was traveling alone. I should have not been alone. I should have been with somebody more cool-headed than I am, who would have known what I knew only after the fact, that I shouldn't have gone anywhere near that gun, much less sat in it.
What are some of the contexts that the photo has subsequently been used in?
Right-wing propaganda. You know, just whenever they want to attack me, they pull that out. It's my fault.
Did you ask for your Freedom of Information Act files when you were writing your memoir?
I did. Yes, I did.
What are some of the things you learned from that?
Before I knew before I started writing my memoirs that you know, that they had followed me and tapped my phone and opened my mail.
With the FBI?
The CIA had opened my mail. It was the first time the CIA had opened the mail of a U.S. citizen. And they admitted to that. I sued the Nixon administration, and in the suit, this came out.
So what else did you learn?
Oh, they took my bank statements without a subpoena. They followed my daughter, who was in kindergarten at the time, and wrote about that. They broke into my home and rifled through my drawers. They tried to get me in every way. They planted fake propaganda, you know, saying things that had never happened. They tried to plant them in various columnists' columns, and it didn't work. But, you know, they'd already taken down Jean Seberg, my friend, the actress, by doing that, and they didn't get me. The people who were trying to get me ended up in jail, and anyway, the rest is history.
Do you mean Watergate people? I mean,
yeah.
Who do you mean?
I mean Watergate people, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson.
How much of this were you aware of as it was happening?
I became aware of it when Jack Anderson...
the investigative columnist.
Yeah. He revealed that my bank statements had been seized. And... Army Archer revealed that he had received a letter from an FBI agent in Los Angeles, the same one that had planted false information about Jean Seberg. And, you know, he told me about that, so I knew that they were engaging in black propaganda. And then we discovered COINTELPRO, which was a J. Edgar Hoover organization designed to destroy, sometimes literally through assassinations, infiltration, black propaganda against people that he felt were opponents of the government. And I was a target of COINTELPRO.
Jane Fonda. Here's a scene from her 1978 movie, Coming Home. She won an Oscar for her portrayal of a volunteer nurse at a VA hospital. While her husband is in Vietnam, she becomes close to a patient, played by John Voight, who came home from the war as a paraplegic. In this scene from early in the film, she's talking with him about her husband.
The captain? Oh, shit, Bender, you didn't go out and marry a f***ing captain, did you?
That's right. Why, where were you?
The sergeant.
So, sergeants have a lot of responsibility, don't they?
Yes, they sent me my stripes on the hospital ship. My reward for getting so f***ed up.
Why are you so cynical about that, Luke?
What are you doing here, Bender? Why aren't you out on the golf course teeing up balls? Doing something you're good at.
I'm just trying to keep busy, that's all.
Sure, it gives you something to talk about over martinis. How you're helping out the poor cripples.
I don't think that I deserve that, Luke, at all.
Maybe you're just getting ready for your husband who came back in a body bag.
A scene from Coming Home. Jane Fonda's new autobiography is called My Life So Far.
Do you feel that you were present at the start of the culture wars and were one of the kind of lightning rods?
Not at all. No, my brother was, but I was a sort of square white bread American making movies like Any Wednesday and Sunday in New York when my brother was making Easy Rider and Wild Angels. I'm usually late to things. I was 7 years late to the Vietnam War and I was late to the cultural things, and there's always a big part of me that's sort of rooted in, I don't know what to call it. I like what the British author David Hare said. The best place to be radical is in the middle. The films that I made myself and produced, they're not revolutionary in terms of stylistically or anything. I want to appeal to middle America.
Tell me what you think of this theory, and I think you actually refer to it in the book, but I've also seen it posited in magazines, that some men found you particularly hard to take when you became involved politically because they so loved you in Barbarella and were so turned on by you in Barbarella. The fact that you in some way turned against them through your politics was just too much to take.
Well, I remember specifically, I put together a show called Free the Army, with Donald Sutherland and a number of other entertainers, and we performed it outside of bases all over the United States and in the Pacific, Hawaii, Okinawa, Japan, the Philippines, and altogether, I think we performed for 60,000 active duty servicemen and a few women. There weren't that many women involved in the military at that time. I think only 10,000, but many service people came to those performances. And we would always have meetings afterwards with them and listen to what they had to say. And Holly Neer, who the singer who was on the tour with us, was told on a number of occasions by guys that they were angry at me, that they'd torn down the Barbarella poster. You know, because I didn't live up to their sexual fantasies. And I write in my book that I love the French expression, bien dans ma peau. I wasn't well enough in my skin to be able to own where I was. Could I do that over again now, I would simply go out, because I didn't wear makeup, I wore blue jeans, I was very plain, I would walk out on stage, and I would say, I know that some of you are going to be disappointed that I'm not Barbarella, but you know, it's not always fun to try to live up to someone's sexual fantasies. I mean, sexual fantasies are great, but if you're the object of it, it can get objectifying, and I'm trying to become a whole person, and you know, I'm sorry that I'm not Barbarella anymore, but I'm trying to be me. I have a feeling that had I been really honest about it, that guys would have been there with me. But I didn't.
Right.
That's
a hard one to
do when you do it. Yeah.
Right. Jane Fonda is my guest. She's written an autobiography. It's called My Life So Far. You've become a Christian, and you end your book talking a little bit about that. How did you become a Christian? I mean, earlier you were talking about that you think that eating disorders represent a kind of spiritual void. Are these two things connected for you?
Well, I didn't realize it at the time, but when my second husband Tom Hayden and I broke up, it was a devastating time for me. I had a breakdown, and everybody said, stay busy, stay busy, but I didn't. I knew that was wrong. What I did was I said, I think I have something to learn, and I said out loud by myself one day, if God wants me to suffer like this, there must be a reason. And I almost did a double take. It was like, did I say God? I was raised an atheist. And shortly thereafter, I heard Bill Moyers say, because coincidences were happening all around me then, and I heard Bill Moyers say, coincidences are God's way of remaining anonymous. Shortly after that, I met Ted Turner and moved to Georgia, which was the first time in my life that I had ever spent intense time with people who were religious, who lived their spirituality, and they were hip and fun and smart, and I began to study, and I began to talk more and more to people, including the Carters and others, and I realized that I was searching for reverence, is the best way to put it. And I am meeting a network of feminists throughout this country who are Christian. And I'm suddenly feeling this is my spiritual home.
Your father was an agnostic. Did he live long enough to know that you had become Christian?
No, it's one of the things that makes me so sad. Dad didn't live long enough to see me become a more whole person, I'm sorry to say.
Now, you have a movie coming out. You have a new movie, Monster in Law, your first movie mm-hmm. in 15 years. Why mm-hmm. why such a long hiatus, and why break that now?
Well, I left 15 years ago, never intending to come back, because I was miserable acting. I was completely living on willpower in my head, and creativity had dried up, and it was a terrifying experience for me every time I had to go to work each day, and I vowed I'd never do it again. And then I met Ted, and I didn't need to do it again. But 15 years later, two things. One is I'm a very different person. I'm not living in my head anymore, and I was curious to know how that would manifest, not even so much on the screen but in the process of making the movie. Would I still be scared when I woke up? Would I be terrified on the set? The answer is no. I had a blast. It was so much fun. And the second reason is money. I'm 67, and I want to create endowments for the work I do in Georgia, and so half my salary went straight into that.
Well, Jane Fonda, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you, Terry.
Jane Fonda's new autobiography is called My Life So Far. Here's a scene from Monster in Law. Fonda plays a snobbish mother who finds out her son, a surgeon, is planning to marry a temp. Jennifer Lopez is the fiancé.
Just so you know, the crying bits are getting old.
Just so you know, Kevin likes his girls thin.
Oh, well, I could always get liposuction. I've been meaning to ask. Is it painful?
That maid of honor bit. Priceless.
Well, you know what they say. Keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer.
Oh.
Now you listen to me. This is my game now. You are going to tell Kevin that you are not moving into our neighborhood and that you've decided that you're feeling like it's time that you go on with your own life. You are moving out of our house immediately. This is over.
This isn't over, not even close, girly.
Well, bring it on, Grandma.
Monster in Law opens May 13th. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio.